You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Joy Cardine. It's 10 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday morning, June the 26th. We will talk about Vice President Dick Cheney's claim that he is not a part of the executive branch of government, so he does not have to comply with an executive order that President Bush issued in 2003, requiring all government agencies that are part of the executive branch to provide information on how much material they classify and declassify to the Information Security Oversight Office at the National Archives. The vice president's office will not comply with the executive order because Cheney says his office is not a part of the executive branch. He says he is with the legislative branch as president of the U.S. Senate. Democrats say Cheney's move is the height of arrogance, and some have suggested that the money for the vice president's office be withheld until he decides whether or not he is with the executive branch or not. We are going to talk about this with John Nichols this hour, who says that Cheney's claim is blatantly ridiculous. And we wonder if you think if it matters or not that the vice president won't comply with this executive order safeguarding classified information because he says he's not a part of the executive branch of government. 1-800-642-1234. 1-800-642-1234. In Madison, 263-1890, 263-1890. Or send an email with your question or comment to talk@wpr.org. Please include your first name and your community with your email. We are happy to have with us John Nichols. He is Washington, D.C. correspondent for The Nation magazine, associate editor of the Capital Times, and author of many books, including The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney. Good morning, John.
Good morning.
So I thought your book's title was Dick, the Man Who Is President.
Well, that was the hardcover title. Unfortunately, when you write books about prominent figures that a lot of people want to read about, they put it out in a lot of different countries, and the international sales were very good on this book. And so when the publisher was deciding when we went to paperback, whether to do the American title or the European title, they went with the European one.
I get it.
it's the same book, yeah. But it's very hard to keep up with publishing.
So you're in Washington, D.C. right now. Are you covering the latest claims of the vice president?
As a matter of fact, I have been.
Yeah.
Not necessarily anticipated. I was out here to do a couple of speeches, but because, you know, anything Cheney, people end up wanting to talk. I'm in that position of having a lot of people want to talk about it. So I've met with several members of Congress to discuss it, and we'll talk to some more today, including Russ Feingold. And at the core level, it's a very funny thing. I mean, you know, the notion of a vice president suggesting that he's not a part of the executive branch. But there are deeper constitutional issues here, and I think you're going to see some interesting congressional action in the next few days, mostly to try and clarify on this, because it is a big deal. You have not merely all the gamesmanship about the National Archives, but you've also got the question of presidential succession and a whole host of other matters. If the vice president starts to claim he's not in that line or somehow alters it, it becomes an interesting constitutional debate.
Gee, well, so what could Congress do to clarify this?
Well, they could cut his money. I mean, that's Rahm Emanuel, who is the chairman of the House Democratic Caucus, and frankly, he's a pretty fierce partisan. I mean, the best way to understand Emanuel is that he's not somebody I would think of on a day-to-day basis as a constitutionalist. His concerns are more of poking at Cheney. Has proposed cutting the funding. And that's a way to highlight the problem. But there actually are a lot of ways that Congress can come in on this. The House and the Senate both have very strong Constitution subcommittees of their judiciary committees. And it happens that Russ Feingold is the chair of the Senate one. A guy named Jerry Nadler is the chair of the House one. And both of them, I think, are very well positioned to raise some of the legitimate concerns. For instance, when President Bush is traveling, or when he may be out of the loop, as he was on September 11th for a period of time, The vice president immediately steps in without any question to a leadership role. And there's no question Cheney played an essential leadership role on September 11th. If Cheney claims that he's not a part of the executive branch, then such a move is not appropriate. Yeah. And so, you know, I think at core we've got a relatively funny question here, but beneath it are some very fundamental questions of the Republic, and ones that if Dick Cheney wants to entertain, I believe some serious and thoughtful people over on Capitol Hill will be glad to entertain it.
We need to check our weather forecast, and then we'll continue talking with and taking your calls for John Nichols, Associate Editor of the Capital Times, Washington, D.C. correspondent for The Nation, and author of The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney. We are talking about Vice President Dick Cheney saying that he is not a member of the executive branch of government and therefore does not have to comply with an executive order. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. It's now 17 minutes past 7 o'clock on this Tuesday, June the 26th. At Issue with Ben Marins comes your way between 4 and 6 this afternoon. After 5, Ben and his guest will talk about the findings of the latest Badger poll on national issues. It finds most Wisconsinites are generally dissatisfied with the way things are going in the country today, and many, no surprise, are unhappy with the war in Iraq. That's after 5 o'clock this afternoon. We are talking about Vice President Dick Cheney and whether or not he is a member of the executive branch of government and whether or not he should be complying with executive orders that tell agencies within the executive branch of government to share information with the National Archives, national security information. Talking with John Nichols, who is the author of the book, The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney, and is also a Washington, D.C. correspondent for The Nation and associate editor for the Capital Times. And we welcome your questions about this for him at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. John, I saw a press conference yesterday with the I forgot her name. Dana Perino, the White House spokesperson.
The always embattled White House spokesperson.
Yeah. Yeah. And reporters were saying, you know, hey, you know, does the president believe that the vice president is part of the executive branch? And she was hemming and hawing her way around this, but then she finally said, well, you know, the vice president does have an executive function and a legislative function, and the president did not intend for the vice president to be a subject of this executive order. So the White House seems to be kind of backing the vice president.
Well, one of the dirty little secrets is that the president is not complying with his executive order either. And so he's got to back the vice president up on it. Unfortunately, the president doesn't have the dodge of saying he's a member of the legislative branch. So this whole thing has, this onion has yet to be carved, peeled, whatever you do to an onion, there's much more to it. And Henry Waxman, who is the chair of a key investigatory committee, is going to be looking at all this. But I do want to take a shot at that actual, you know, fantasy about that. The notion that the vice president's legislative duties are equal to or even comparable to his executive branch duties. Mm-hmm. To give you an example of this, many people have a full-time job and then something else they do. Maybe they're the treasurer of their church and they get paid a few bucks for doing that. Mm-hmm. In any realistic sense, that is the extent to which Dick Cheney is a legislator. He has the responsibility to break ties in the Senate and a few administrative responsibilities that could essentially be handled by an assistant. So he is not in any functional way a member of the legislative branch, and that's exactly how the founders intended it. And the way we confirm that is actually through a subtlety of the Constitution, but one that's very, very clear. The vice president is clearly identified as an individual who can be impeached by the Congress. Now, the Congress cannot impeach its own members. And so that reference to impeachment of the vice president, which is made several times in the executive sections of the Constitution, makes absolutely clear and would be clear for any judge or any interpreter that the vice president is a member of the executive branch.
Oh, simply by using that word, impeach.
There's no way it could be otherwise.
Yeah,
and no reading that would make it possible for it to be otherwise.
I saw some talking heads on TV, though, last night, and I think it was Chris Matthews, not that he's a constitutional law expert, but he was going on and on about how the vice president receives his paycheck from the Senate, from the legislative branch, and that that the Constitution spells out those legislative duties, but nothing except succession to the president when it comes to executive duties.
Again, Chris has to read the full executive section of the Constitution, and I know him. He's a good guy. But anybody who is trying to find a reading of the Constitution that would suggest the founders intended for the vice president to be a functionary of, a part of, a operative within the legislative branch is not reading that core component, which is that the legislative branch can remove the vice president in the same way that they would remove a president, but in a way that they cannot remove any legislator.
Yeah. Well, I mean, what is your take, John, on the vice president saying this about especially this executive order, that I'm not a part of the executive branch, therefore I don't have to, you know, safeguard national security information with the National Archives?
Well, that's the comedy of this fight, right? Because Dick Cheney does deal in a great deal of classified information. In fact, the whole Scooter Libby controversy involved the declassification of information and then the release of that information to reporters. But the one thing that's been absolutely steady throughout the Bush presidency is that Dick Cheney doesn't share classified or declassified information with the Congress. He's been incredibly closed-mouthed, incredibly difficult to deal with in this regard. So the notion that because he's a legislator, he doesn't fall under these rules, you know, would assume that, you know, he's somehow loyal to or engaged with the legislative branch. It's quite the opposite. Dick Cheney, to a greater extent than any vice president in American history, has dealt in classified information, has been highly engaged both in classification and declassification. And the reason the National Archives is particularly interested in his office is because a lot of it goes on there. When I wrote the biography of Cheney, I spent a lot of time talking to intelligence officers, including people like former intelligence officers and ambassadors like Joe Wilson. And, you know, what they said to a one is that Dick Cheney deals with more classified information than George Bush.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why folks are interested, and that's also why this fight becomes a really fascinating one. Because, you know, the archives, what they're trying to do is, it's not the executive order that's the big deal. It's actually a law passed back in the 1990s. And the reason this is done is because for a lot of American history, we had a very unregulated presidency as regards classified information. And in the Nixon era, again, in the Reagan era, and in the Bill Clinton era, we had real problems with presidents claiming that they had moved something from a classified status to a declassified status, but there being no record of this, you know, no clarity on it. And so the archives was brought in to just kind of, not to know what the specific document was, but simply to know whether it had been, what status it had been moved from.
Let's take some calls. Lots of people want to talk with you. Joe in Wapaka, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks. I guess I have kind of a two-part question. First of all, you know, Dick Cheney has been doing anything he can, really, to avoid any transparency in his position. And that goes back to his meeting with leaders in the energy industry to form our energy policy. And I guess I'm wondering if there's any...
Oh, you know, I'm so sorry, Joe. We are losing you on your cell phone there. Can't hear you. But I
think we got the guts of his question.
Yeah.
Look, Dick Cheney's opposition to transparency actually goes back, in intriguingly enough, to the 1970s when he was chief of staff for President Gerald Ford. I mean, remember, this guy's been around Washington a long time, and he has always been obsessed with secrecy and obsessed with allowing the executive branch to do what it chooses without congressional or regulatory oversight. Famously, back in the 1980s, when he was a member of Congress from Wyoming, During the Iran-Contra scandal, Dick Cheney was placed on the investigatory committee. That committee released a scathing report on the abuses of executive privilege in foreign policy matters by the Reagan administration. The Democrats and Republicans in key positions in the House and Senate backed that report. Amazingly, one member wrote a minority report and objected to it and said, you know, no, the president should be able to do whatever he wants without congressional oversight. That member was Dick Cheney, and he has held to this view very intently throughout his legislative and executive branch career, and certainly what the caller referenced is exactly right. The first real fight with the Bush administration over transparency and over executive cooperation with the rest of government came within 10 days of the Bush-Cheney administration taking office, when the vice president made it absolutely clear that he would be meeting with executives of firms such as Halliburton and all sorts of energy corporations, Enron, and not reveal the details of those meetings, not even reveal the schedule of when those meetings were held.
Yeah, and he said he didn't need to turn over the records of the energy meetings because he was a member of the executive branch.
Of course. Well, look, that's the comedy of this thing. I mean, Dick Cheney has used his status as a member of the executive branch literally hundreds of times to refuse to cooperate. He has also, I mean, let's be take it at that official level, forms that go back and forth, but let's also look at just the pattern of his relationship with the legislative branch. He is, to our knowledge, the only vice president in the history of the country to go to the Senate and spew obscenities at the ranking Democrat on the Judiciary Committee. I mean, this is not a guy who likes cooperating with the legislative branch.
Yeah, he's not very congenial there. We did get a call, and we have to break for news in about a minute or so, but a caller who didn't want to stay online, who wanted to point out that the Speaker of the House is third in line for the presidency, and she is not a part of the executive branch.
Absolutely true. And the way that the Constitution is written is very, very clear on this. The Speaker of the House is clearly a member of the House of Representatives, and it is true that she is in the line of succession, but the line of succession is not the only thing that we're concerned about here. There's a whole bunch of different matters. I would suggest that if the vice president is putting himself in the legislative branch, that does raise a host of concerns as regards line of succession. But the speaker's status is not in question here. She is not claiming to be a member of the executive branch.
Mm-hmm. That being third in line is more of her job chairing the church committee.
The fact of the matter is that it'll never happen. Once we created the Presidential Succession Act, back I think in the 60s, you eliminated that reality because, frankly, if a vice president stepped down, a new one will be appointed. So the speaker becoming president is really almost an unimaginable concept.
We're talking with John Nichols. He is Washington correspondent for The Nation magazine, associate editor of the Capital Times, author of The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney, talking about Vice President Richard Cheney declaring he is not a member of the executive branch of government and therefore not going to comply with an executive order on national security issues. John says this is ridiculous. What do you say? This is the Ideas Network. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Joy Cardine. Good to have you along on this Tuesday morning, June the 26th. It's 7:36. Is the Vice President of the United States a part of the executive branch of government? Well, that's what most of us learned in civics class, but the Vice President, Dick Cheney, says that's not the case. The Vice President says his office is not a part of the executive branch. He says he's with the legislative branch. He's president of the U.S. Senate. And because of that, he says he does not have to comply with an executive order on safeguarding classified information. Well, Democrats are crying foul, and some are saying this is the height of arrogance. One, Rahm Emanuel, the chair of the House Democratic Caucus, is proposing cutting off the funding for the vice president's office until the vice president can decide whether or not he's with the executive branch. We wonder what you think, what questions you have about this, and whether or not this is important or not, as to whether or not the vice president is in the executive branch or the legislative branch. Our guest says it is. John Nichols, Washington, D.C. correspondent for The Nation magazine, associate editor for the Capital Times, author of The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney. And back to the phones we go. Jeff in Madison is our next caller. Hi, Jeff. You're on the air.
Hello. I guess my question is, in the current system, we get one vote for two people right now. We elect the president and the vice president together. And to me, that just seems really odd that now they're not a team anymore.
Yeah, I'm sure that George Bush is kind of a little bit heartbroken here. His buddy's claiming not to be, on the team or with the campaign anymore. But the reality is, of course, this is a structural game that's being played. Cheney does not want to cooperate with the National Archives. What the caller should know and what listeners should know is that I've spent a lot of time charting the vice president's relationship with the president. And the fact of the matter is that these are the closest vice president and president arguably in the history of the country, certainly since Henry Wallace worked very closely with Franklin Roosevelt back in the 1940s. They meet every day. The president and vice president usually have either a late morning meeting of about an hour or they have lunch together. And reality is that Dick Cheney is the most engaged and policy-wise significant vice president ever. So I don't think that President Bush is feeling particularly neglected here.
Thanks, Jeff, for the call. John in Madison is with us now. Hi, John.
Yeah, well, it's part and parcel of a trend, the trend of toleration of accepted contradictions that you see throughout this administration. You know, at one level, I can see why Cheney would be mad about this, because he knows he really is the president, so who's this upstart to tell him anything? But on a serious note, in the late 40s, the CIA established the principle of plausible deniability. In other words, you have an alibi ready when you break the law or you do something immoral, not only to foreign governments to deny them the reality of what you're doing, but also to the internal population. In this country, in the mid-70s, we had the Pike and Church committees that said, we can see where this is going. This is leading to an authoritarian government. We need a congressional check oversight on the executive. And what you see in this current administration is you see them doing this over and over again. Yes, we torture. We just change the definition. Yes, we deny habeas corpus. We just change the definition of enemy combatants. Yes, I did do warrantless wiretaps, but I had to because the situation warranted it. In other words, the neocon administration doesn't believe what happened in the 70s was valid, and they're doing everything possible to recreate the same situation in the 2000 era. This is absolutism, and the Democrats better not draw back from this kind of stuff, because it is something that is destroying this government. I mean, either we have checks and balances or we don't.
I think John is exactly right, and there's a historical note here that's significant or perhaps useful, and that is that when the Church and Pike committees and commissions that he speaks of were in play back in the 1970s, and you really did have, in the waning days of Richard Nixon's administration, during much of Gerald Ford's administration, a real pushback from Congress, a reassertion of separation of powers and checks and balances. The man who was in the White House really scrambling to try and prevent it from going too far, trying to maintain as much executive power as possible, was a young political aide named Dick Cheney. His formative years were, as a political player, as a significant political player, were during the period when Congress was in the ascendancy and you were really seeing the Constitution followed in a much more meticulous manner. You can argue that Cheney's whole career has been about getting to moments such as this, where it is possible for the executive branch to pretty much say or do whatever it wants.
Yeah. Thank you, John, for the call. Keith in Shorewood, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, John and Joy, good morning. This looks like what we're going to have here is the start of an ongoing series of constitutional crises, but we only have those if somehow Congress manages to find their dentures and start sinking their teeth in their few places. I'm just wondering, you know, because of course Congress lately has seen a drop in their popularity, and I think a lot of that's probably attributed to the fact that people were expecting things to happen from this Congress, and they're not. Do you think at some point Congress is going to stop following the path of people like David Broder and such who feel that we can't have gridlock? People don't like gridlock, or do you think they're going to find themselves and start doing something about this abuse of power?
Keith's gotten to the core question there, and that is, you know, what do we do about it? The history of the Bush administration for the first six years was really one of an administration that did things that were far outside the bounds of both the constitutional parameters of federal government and also tradition in this country, and a Congress that, by and large, had no response whatsoever, or in many cases aided and abetted those abuses. Now we have a supposedly opposition Congress with Democrats in charge of the House and Senate, but frankly they've been staggeringly cautious as regards reasserting constitutional principles. The amazing thing is that currently in Congress, some of the people who are speaking most bluntly and I think most effectively about a real assertion of checks and balances and the Congress, you know, stepping forward much more aggressively are not Democrats but some Republicans, people like John Duncan of Tennessee and Ron Paul, who many people know, who's a sort of an outsider mm-hmm. candidate for the Republican nomination for president. And that is it's a really interesting contradiction, because I do think one of the reasons that the approval rating for Congress is so low right now is that Americans have expectations of the different branches of government, and they have expectations about what an opposition party would do. And frankly, the Democrats have not filled that role so far. Until they do, you're going to have a lot of confusion about what's going on in Washington, I think a lot of disappointment. But most importantly, you're going to have a failure to reassert basic principles of the republic. That's problematic. It ought to concern not just people who don't like Bush and Cheney, but also people who don't like Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama or John Edwards, because at the end of the day, the abuse of presidential powers, if it is not checked, carries forward into the next administration and allows the next president and vice president to be just as abusive of the Constitution as Bush and Cheney have been.
Yeah, Eugene Robinson, in a piece, an editorial piece, wrote, "I am often asked why, given my lower than low opinion of this administration, I don't raise the subject of whether George W. Bush should be impeached. I answer with three scary words that tend to end the discussion: President Dick Cheney."
Yeah. That's an absurdity. I mean, you know, Eugene Robinson's smarter than that, and he should write better columns. And the fact of the matter is, so too should other players who fall into that trap for two reasons. Number one, the founders didn't say, you know, look, we only apply the rule of law in the United States when people we like are going to succeed, when we're going to gain partisan political advantage. That's the core sort of moral reality here. But the secondary reality is that if you've got problems with the Bush-Cheney administration, you can impeach Cheney first. The founders drew very, very specific parameters and rules and regulations as regards impeachment, and they outlined them for a vice president just as a president. And I will point out that the only operative proposal for impeachment at this point in Congress is Dennis Kucinich's proposal to impeach Cheney.
Yeah. Our guest, John Nichols, Washington, D.C. correspondent for The Nation, associate editor for the Capital Times in Madison, author of The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney, talking with us about Vice President Dick Cheney and his declaration that he doesn't need to comply with an executive order because he and his office, not a member of the executive branch of government. 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network. This is the Ideas Network. I'm Joy Cardine. 13 minutes before 8 o'clock, coming up after 8, I'll talk with one of the architects of a proposal by Senate Democrats in Wisconsin to bring universal health care to the state. So a universal health care plan unveiled yesterday, and John Erpenbach, Democratic State Senator from Middleton, will talk with you about it after 8 o'clock. We're talking about Vice President Dick Cheney, whether or not he's a member of the executive branch. He says he's not. Our guest and most constitutional scholars say he is. John Nichols, talking with you at 1-800-642-1234 in Madison, 263-1890. Dave in Wanakee is next. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi. I was wondering, what's to prevent the Bush administration from going into a paper shredding mode at the end of its life as an administration? And are there laws on the books that will prevent such things from happening?
Well, Dave asks a great question here, because that's exactly what this National Archives rule relates to. It goes to the question of, kind of keeping a track record, keeping a schedule of what documents, what policies the administration is dealing with, so that then you can check back, not in a period where it would endanger the country, where classified information might be revealed, but in the future, from a historical standpoint, to make sure and to understand what was done. And so though there are rules and regulations on the books that absolutely bar the administration from destroying communications, from destroying paperwork and documents that they've dealt with. That's one of the reasons why President Bush does not use email, because there are even federal regulations and rules, and certainly interpretations of regulations and rules that suggest that you cannot destroy emails sent and received in an official capacity. So, yeah, that all exists, but I think to go to the core of Dave's question, does one suspect that members of this administration, with their penchant for secrecy and with their almost obsessive efforts to prevent transparency, does one suspect that you might see destruction of communications? Yeah, I think it's a legitimate concern at this point, based on the pattern of activity of the administration, not based on whether you like these people or dislike them, not based on whether you're Republican, Democrat, conservative, liberal, but their pattern of activity suggests a legitimate concern.
Bob in Verona is with us now. Hi, Bob.
Good morning. John, it's amazing. Every day we awaken to more contempt of Congress by this administration and violations of the rule of law. And I guess I've sort of gotten to the point of wondering, is this building a stronger case for impeachment, or have we become totally desensitized by the overwhelming violations? And if we did want to impeach, I think we could do it in a week, because people have written reports with all the materials that are needed.
I think your question's a good one, and I think that you see the absolute disconnect between official Washington and the grassroots of the country. When I travel around the U.S., and I speak a lot on these constitutional issues, I never, ever fail to have people bring up the subject of impeachment. And intriguingly enough, John Murtha, a senior member of Congress who's not a supporter of impeachment, says the same thing. Wherever he goes, the first thing people want to talk about is impeachment. So it's clearly something that a lot of grassroots Americans come to, a conclusion they reach after looking at the things that have happened over the last 6 years. That is not a response that is broadly afoot within the Congress at this point. There is an impeachment proposal that's been put forward by Dennis Kucinich, the congressman from Ohio. It has 8 or 9 co-sponsors at this point, which is not a significant number. And, I really do believe, though, that this particular controversy, as well as a few other controversies that are in play right now, which are in the investigatory process, that are seeing committees look into them, and particularly the Alberto Gonzalez situation, could lead to a tipping point. That tipping point on impeachment will not come with a hearing by a committee. It will come with the issuance of a subpoena or a request for a member of the administration to appear before a committee, to appear before a congressional committee, or to cooperate with it, and a refusal. At the point of that refusal, then the issue goes to the courts. And if you remember the Watergate controversy, it was only when the fight between the executive and the legislative branch got to the courts, and John Sirica, who is a federal judge, and others stepped in, that really the subject of impeachment kind of rose to the front of the agenda. I think that's the only way at this point that impeachment becomes a viable option. again, that being if there is a clear confrontation between the legislative and the executive, and the courts step in strongly on the side of the legislative.
Rich in Sullivan is with us now. Hi, Rich.
Hi. My metaphor here will be a tortured one, but I think by me, that is, but I think I'm permitted that, considering how torture is now regarded in our nation, and that is this. Too many of us in our personal domestic life, in our professional associations, in our business practices, and so on and so forth, often look the other way. And we have had this case in Wisconsin of a boy locked in a room and tortured in the Portage area until something broke. And here's what I'm speaking of. This interpretation that Dick Cheney has given us of his understanding of our Constitution is so demented and so illogical that it fits within the analysis of an Al Gore's book, The Assault on Reason, or Glenn Greenwald's How Would a Patriot Act, another book that I'm currently reading. And we cannot permit ourselves to be citizens, whether in a small community or in a state or in a nation, and allow our Constitution, because we are a child of a nation in the world of nations. We really are. We are a young concept of how people govern themselves. We cannot allow this kind of abuse to occur.
Rich, I really appreciate your comment. We're running short on time, and while you're very eloquent, there's a buzz on your phone. John, you agree with Rich?
Yeah, I think, as he says, it's a somewhat tortured analogy, but one that goes to the heart of the matter. Vice President Cheney asserts this power because he thinks he can get away with it, and that's not uncommon in politics. I've seen Democrats and Republicans do that, but it really begs a question not of Cheney, but of the rest of us. How offended do we become by this? How angry do we get, and what do we demand of our elected representatives? You know, it is very, very possible to hold a vice president or a president to account. We have a constitution that outlines how we do it, and clearly the vice president has expressed a great disregard for that constitution. The question then is, citizens going to say that's inappropriate? We don't accept that, and we demand that our elected representatives do something about it.
Jack in Dousman is with us now. Hi, Jack.
Hi. I have a statement. I don't want to be derogatory to national radio because public radio because I listen all the time. But my comment is this: I see two people in Washington sitting back in their chairs, rocking back and forth, and laughing their damn heads off. Because with this subject that we have right now, we have completely taken the immigration thing out of the news, off the papers, and the immigration thing, in my estimation, is the biggest thing in the world right now. We are invaded, but Cheney and Bush are sitting back and saying, ha, 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 commerce is talking about something else again. That's all I have to say.
I'll give you comfort. Mm-hmm. The Senate's going to be dealing with immigration today.
That's right.
And it'll be a major vote, maybe the vote that either advances or kills the bill. And while we're having a good discussion here, and I think a very important one, my suspicion is that this evening's news headlines will be regarding immigration and not the vice president.
That's right. We've done a gazillion programs on immigration. Do you have a prediction, John, on how that's going to work out in the Senate?
I hate to tell you, but my gut instinct is that President Bush is so disempowered at this point that he's not able to rally the Republicans. And I could be wrong, but I suspect that when all is said and done, the comprehensive immigration reform will not go forward, at least not in the form that's been advanced so far.
Yeah. You know, I know, John, the Capital Times is running the Washington Post series, or at least part of the series, on Vice President Dick Cheney. And there was one line that I wanted you to comment on. It says, Cheney is not, by nearly every inside account, the shadow president of popular lore, but really serving President Bush's aims. What do you think of that conclusion?
Look, Cheney and Bush have a complex relationship. Cheney has wanted to exercise executive power going back to the 1970s, and he does so in conjunction with President Bush. I don't think that he necessarily does anything that President Bush doesn't want to do, but remember that President Bush has very, very limited experience in foreign policy, mm-hmm. especially as well as with Congress. And so I think Cheney is certainly in the role of what you used to see as a prince regent, operating with a very young king in Britain or some European country, and the prince regent always exercised a great deal of authority, and you never really knew where the line was between the president's desire, or between the king's desire and the prince regent's, or between the president's and the vice president's.
We'll leave it there. We're out of time. Thank you very much, John, for being with us.
It's a great pleasure.
John Nichols, he is the associate editor of the Capital Times, Washington, D.C. correspondent for The Nation, author of many books, including The Rise and Rise of Richard B. Cheney, talking with us about the controversy over Vice President Cheney declaring he's not a member of the executive branch of government and therefore does not have to comply with an executive order regarding national security information. Thanks to Karen Prager for producing this hour, and thanks to Christina Taylor for on-air production. As always, thank you for listening and for calling in. I hope you stay tuned. There's much more to come. I'm Joy Cardine. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.